From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
Shut up and drive. You don't know what you're talking about. He's not the one. You ought to know that by now. You've got one of those hearts.
By the late 1990s, Shelley Wright was already a country music superstar, topping the charts and gathering armloads of industry awards as the new millennium began. But Shelley was facing internal conflicts dating back to earlier millennia, as her identity as a lesbian seemed incompatible with both her deep Christian faith and the conservative country music industry. Shelley tells the story of what happened next, both in a powerful book and the documentary Wish Me Away, as well as in a previous interview on this program. And in recent years, Shelley has been thriving as a wife, a mom, an outspoken activist with a particular passion for fighting the spiritual abuse of LGBTQI+ young persons, and has even managed to maintain a large fan base for her music, demonstrating how far we've come from the bigoted stereotypes of earlier times. As we get the chance to maybe catch our breath a little bit after the nonstop chaos of recent years, I wanted to take the time to catch up with Shelley and get her thoughts on politics, the pandemic, and performing arts, among other topics. And on this week's show, we'll dedicate the full show to an extended conversation with Shelley Wright. This month, State of Belief is celebrating 15 years of weekly broadcast from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. So much of that work has only been possible thanks to the generous support of our listeners. Now, if you've made a donation this week, please, please know how thankful we are for that. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, it feels partisan to cheer the many actions rapidly taken by the Biden administration in its first days. But I would feel compelled to cheer these actions no matter who were to take them. On this show, we did not have a hard time finding moral as well as practical reasons for condemning the previous administration's arbitrary ban on transgender service members, and so we celebrate the reversal of that outrageous action. We shared the pain and anger of so many when the so-called Muslim ban went from obscene campaign talking point to embarrassing national policy. And so we salute the simple resumption of sanity and national security as the guiding principles of our border policies. And the same can be said for cruel zero-tolerance family separation policies at the southern border, addressing a climate crisis that is already causing untold suffering among the most marginalized people across the globe, and putting science first in fighting the COVID pandemic. I don't care who does it or which party they represent. I'm just glad these things are getting done. As we closely watch the future actions of the Biden-Harris administration, you can be sure we will not hesitate to speak out when actions or statements challenge our core values of true religious freedom for all and the inclusive pluralistic vision of our nation. We believe the Constitution embodies and toward which our founders directed us. But it has been an encouraging week and a half so far, and I am both relieved and ready to say so. Now to our guest. Shelley Wright is a public figure, a woman unafraid of speaking out for what she believes, and a talented singer-songwriter whose art has moved millions. I was delighted that she agreed to find time in her busy schedule to be back with us on State of Belief. I head into this conversation with Shelley excited at the possibilities, but unsure of the direction it will take. I just know that I am so happy to have Shelley Wright with us again on State of Belief Radio. Dear friend, welcome.
Thank you, Welton. It's so good to be back with you. Your voice is a balm for my soul and beyond.
Did you say a bomb? A B-O-M-B?
B-A-L-M. A balm.
I understand.
I guess I should be clear about that. However, there are explosions of love going off inside of my heart. You and I, we've been trying to connect for the past, well, since the holidays.
That's
and
right.
It's been a crazy year, I know, for everyone. And I'm glad to finally be able to hear you in my ear balls.
Well, same here. Well, Shelley, you've never been a simplistic person, so I know that I won't get a simplistic answer. If I ask you, how are you feeling in the days since the inauguration?
Right. You know me. I made it a point to make sure I savored the moment. I have been struggling through the pandemic, as everyone has, with just an overwhelming sense of just loss and grief and despair and outrage. But I promised myself if we, because it looked like we won, and then there were arguments about, you know, it was very clear that that Joe Biden, I say we, I wanted him to win. It looked very clear that he won, and there was some discussion about whether the inauguration would happen, if Donald Trump was going to hold power. So I made a mental and spiritual note to myself that on the day that President Biden and Vice President Harris were inaugurated, that I would savor it because I needed that. Mm-hmm. And so I did. And I cried a nice cleansing cry that I needed. And in the days since, I think kind of that loss and outrage and despair and I'm not hopeless at all. In fact, I'm quite hopeful. My optimism has been restored to some degree, but I have been, I'm worried.
Mm-hmm.
I'm worried about the bar that has been lowered so far. It's underground. I'm worried about decency. I'm worried about truth. So that said, I am also in part more optimistic than I've been in a long time.
I'm curious how you and Lauren managed what kind of information reached your boys during the era of lies that we're just coming out of. How old are they now?
They'll be 8 in May. So they're identical twins, as you know, George and Everett. And that is a great question, Welton, and it's been a moving target. So in late March, after a couple of weeks of being on lockdown, Lauren and I called an audible and packed up the car with just enough that we could get in it, toys, clothes, you know, our necessities. And we we left Manhattan, and you know, we were torn to, in doing that, because there's something about leaving the city that needs you. But there was nothing that we could do for the city, and everything we could do for our boys to get them in a place where they could run and play and be outside while still doing remote learning. Little boys are tricky little animals, as you know, Welton. You got to burn off. I mean, little girls as well. I mean, there's just an energy that they have to kind of burn through before they can sit and focus on schoolwork. So, you know, we had to tell them very early on, you know, that there was a virus. And, you know, we took them out for walks in the city a couple of times. I think it was day 15. We left our apartment and took them for a walk. The city was completely dead, nothing going on. And I about lost my mind when one of them touched the handrail at the empty abandoned Met. On the, you know, on the stairs outside, one of them touched, you know, a rail up near the door. And I didn't know what that meant. Does that mean we have it now? He has it? You know, what do we do? So at that point, we had to kind of fill them in. And we've just had an ongoing discussion between Lauren and me about what is appropriate. And then, you know, the lies that have happened during the administration, we just, you know, we had to say it. You know, these are lies. Our president is telling us lies. His supporters are in Congress are telling us lies. And so the night before the election, Lauren and I had a big discussion after we put them to bed. And I asked her, what do we tell them if he wins again? And they woke up the next morning and they said, who won? And we were like, we don't know. They are interesting and resilient and smart and much more wise than we give them credit for. They know that truth matters, and so it's been an evolving discussion.
Shelley, you've been outspoken in social media on the issues that you care about, particularly in terms of how this administration's actions impacted those issues. Has that ever felt risky for you as a public figure?
Yes, it has. And I feel pretty safe here in New York City. But, you know, I think people aren't hard to find. When somebody wants to find somebody, they're not too hard to find. You know, I have had death threats. I have had in varying degrees, some that were taken very seriously and we've, you know, engaged law enforcement. And then some where, you know, people send me a DM on social media that they, you know, they want to be the one to, you know, clobber me. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I'm not reckless. I don't post about where I am at the time. I tend to post about where I was earlier in the day or the day before. So, you know, it's certainly something that a person who has any kind of public, you know, platform must be aware of, and certainly never more before than now. The violent rhetoric has been ratcheted up. Donald Trump is the receding tide that lowers all ships. And, you know, violence is a component to that.
Shelley, where do you see the most damage having happened that will need to be repaired?
Ooh, leave it to you, Welton, to always ask the nuanced, difficult questions. Where has the damage happened that most needs repaired? Truth. Truth.
Mm-hmm.
I think I believe that. You know, when it used to, remember when a politician used to get caught in a lie and they were just so embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And they would hold a press conference and say, you know, I'm going to take some time to think about this with my family. I'm stepping down from my position. That used to be so kind of solely based on, it was binary. If you were caught as a non-truth teller, that was the threshold. I worry that that threshold no longer exists. It has not held. And the doubling down on the lie, you know, alternate facts and parallel truths and data, I am not sure how we recover from that.
In the years since you burst onto the country music scene, there's been such a polarization in our nation, and in some ways, country music became the soundtrack of a part of our community that was increasingly disaffected and angry. I mean, hearing a Charlie Daniels song on the radio is a far cry from marching into the Capitol building carrying a Confederate flag. But I get the feeling there were cultural divides that hardened into something far darker. And because your success came at a time when you were hiding part of yourself while living in that world, I just wonder if you might not have some unique insights on both the divide that we face and the way it kept deepening.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, to your point about my being hidden during that time as a gay woman, which, you know, that was my decision. And I, you know, I've run it up the flagpole and down 1,000 times to imagine a scenario in which I would have found the courage or the wherewithal to come forward sooner. You know, I wish I had. I'm gentle with myself, however, in knowing that it's worth it to hide until the very moment it's not. And I did a lot of rationalizing about why I needed to hide. And, you know, my careers in entertainment, and I think careers anywhere, it's, you know, that's your everything. That's what you work your whole life to do. And I've really kind of stopped beating myself up about whether or not I know I could have moved the needle sooner in terms of the discussion about LGBT issues in country music. I know I could have moved it sooner. Had I come out the week I had a number one record in 1999, I could have moved the needle sooner. I didn't. That said, you're right about there's a huge chasm between listening to a song and it talks about celebration of the South and Southern culture. And there's a huge chasm between that and putting on a flak vest and carrying a long gun into the or a short gun into the Capitol with zip ties. In my mind, those aren't the same people. It's easy to kind of Google map up to 50,000 feet and draw a line, but I think that one should be cautious when doing that. I think it is as nuanced as anything else on the planet. There was a divide in culture between the haves and the have-nots, and it just seemed to be that the have-nots gravitated toward country music, hardworking, blue-collar, you know, people of minimal resources, you know, farm workers, factory workers. And then I think the political class did kind of, I think that divide got bigger and more pronounced. And then I think it got dangerous when people like, and if it sounds like I'm picking on Donald Trump, I am, because he's their mascot. But people like Donald Trump saw those fissures and leveraged them. You know, he's not a conservative. He's not a person of faith. He says he is. He's, you know, you will know them by their fruits. The man is not a person of faith. Yeah. And I am very careful, by the way, to make judgments on a person's faith. I understand that that is a slippery slope, but I'm going on record, as I have with you before, Donald Trump is not a man with a faith practice, not in a serious way. So he, you know, he came in and saw that gap. And saw that that disgruntled population, that population that did have a valid complaint, that population that was left behind, and he got in there and he wiggled in there and he leveraged it and he introduced notions of you know, violence. Mm-hmm. He asked for it. He talked about it. He celebrated it. You know, I'll never forget that rally that he had where he said, I just remember in the good old days, they used to knock the hell out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I knew then we are in trouble.
Yeah. So what do you think about lawmakers who were clearly complicit in the storming of the U.S. Capitol? Are you hopeful there might be consequences?
I wish there would be, but I don't think there will be. I think back in the day when a billboard went up that said so-and-so resign, you know, when there was an appetite in the public to hold someone accountable, their caucus would, you know, generally go to them behind closed doors and say, Bob, it's time. You got to go. You know, Sally, it's time. You crossed a line. I don't think the caucus has courage. I don't think that any, you know, I think Josh Hawley will resign or be expelled? No. Do I think Ted Cruz is going anywhere? Nope.
Mm-hmm. Well, the essential next question is, how do we start healing in this nation? And you know, I feel really comfortable asking you that question because you and I both have had times when we had to ask that question, how do we start the healing? When some identities seem to have hardened around a certain kind of nationalism or fundamentalist Christianity, even racial identity, instead of the kind of patriotism that Dr. King or JFK promoted, are there shared values that you see that can still give solid hope for the future of our society?
I do think there are shared values, but this has been largely a branding and marketing campaign, no side is impervious to how powerfully this marketing campaign kind of lands. So I've seen it for years, as you know, in there being an effort to take away the faith component for a person like me. Like I received registered letters from churches when I came out, you know, cease and desist, stop saying you are a lesbian Christian. It's not possible. It's not compatible. Stop saying it. So there's been a pretty big marketing campaign around telling the evangelical right that that the left doesn't believe in family or faith or patriotism. So I don't know, you know, I don't mean to sound pessimistic, Welton, because again, I feel I'm an optimistic person. You know that about me. But until or unless some of this, someone steps to the middle and says, all right, we have to stop. We have to stop telling people that the left are socialist, communist, people without values, people who don't love their families, pedophiles. I mean, there's a largely held belief among a certain Q population that Joe Biden is a pedophile and that there are cannibals eating children in the ranks of the left. I don't know how we heal until we recalibrate truth. So, you know, in my world of growing up on a farm in Kansas and then moving to Nashville and doing what I've done in entertainment and growing up into an adult person who is in a marriage, you really don't get to expect healing until someone is accountable for what they did. So, for instance, my wife ran the bathtub over last night accidentally, flooded our bathroom. And I always warn her about this. Lauren, be careful. Watch the tub. It ran over last night, big time. And she came to me after I sopped up all the water and our nanny was in there helping us. We were so, I mean, it was crazy. And She said, "Are you mad?" And I said, "No, I'm not mad." And she said, "I just need to say I'm sorry. I did that." And you can heal from then. We could then laugh about it. But until she said, "I know you've warned me about that 1,000 times. I'm so sorry." You know, I was pretty hot. And then when she said, "I know Captain Safety has warned me 1,000 times. Sorry." Then we could laugh about it. We could move on. But until or unless she said that, I was mad. I was pretty hot about it. So unless or until truth is recalibrated, I don't know, Welton. Yeah. I don't know.
I'm very conscious of the fact that as we celebrate 15 years of State of Belief Radio, Shelley Wright in 2006 was in a very different place than you are today. We were launching this radio program, and you, after releasing your sixth studio album this previous year, were in a period of great struggle and suffering. I try to think back to those first weeks in the studio for our show, which was not welcomed by everybody. There were people not interested in having someone who had religion related to his name. I remember some of the other people who were complaining that a minister was being brought on to talk about religion in the progressive community. And it was different for you. Could you ever have imagined then what life is like for you now?
Yes, which was the thing that got me through the tunnel, which was the thing that kept me from ending my life and getting on my knees and saying, "God, show me the way." And I knew clearly there was a way for me. I knew it was going to be fraught with complication and some struggle and some kind of reinvention and, you know, certainly some backlash. But to answer your question, could I have imagined it? It's the only thing that kept me in the game was the imagination that I could have all of the pieces of myself on pulled together, in a way that felt whole. Mm-hmm. I knew these pieces of me existed: a person of faith, a person who's patriotic, a person who loves playing the Grand Ole Opry. I have Midwestern values. I did imagine. I mean, I knew it wasn't going to be easy, and my relationship with you and your counsel and friendship and the kind of support group that I was able and lucky to build around me fortified me and kept me headed toward my true north, which I believed in the moment I got on my knees and said, "Okay, my way is not working. What is your way for me?" And I knew very clearly, okay, there is a way, there is a place and a time and a way in which you can exist as the whole you. Let's get it done. I did. Actually.
Yeah. You have such a passion for defending and protecting LGBTQI+ youth, Shelley, and especially because we've gone through such a cruel period of ridiculing and rejecting people who are different. I can't help but ask you to speak to young people who may be feeling alone and on the margins right now, who may not have that strong a memory of what came before 2016 as they struggle with their own sexuality or identity. What would you say to them?
There's a lot to say. I'm lucky to get to talk to a lot of folks through Facebook Messenger and DM on social media and emails. And I'm lucky to get to kind of hear what they're going through. And it has gotten markedly more difficult for that population in the past 4 years. Again, you know, there was a tide of the change happening. And I know you felt it. You were part of it, and I felt it. And the Trump administration, again, was the receding tide that, you know, that left all ships kind of stranded. And it was a painful, difficult time for a lot of folks. I would tell those young people that, you know, I try to ask them to read my book or watch certain documentaries or read certain articles. I would tell them that they're not alone and that they're not broken, and that those pieces of who they are, if it's, you know, if it's a person with a faith practice or, you know, they love, you know, they love all of the pieces of themselves, but feel like that gay part or that trans part just won't ever fit. I guess I would say that I'd tell them to hang on because help is coming. But a lot of that help is just an internal reckoning and an understanding that, you know, there are millions of people like them out there struggling. And that they're not alone. We're pack animals. When we can understand that we're not having an experience that another human being, that we are having an experience that another human being is having, I just can't tell you how comforting that is. Mm-hmm. I know when I was closeted for so long, I really was having this conversation with a friend the other day. Growing up in Kansas, I thought I was the only gay person on the planet. Mm. My preacher was talking about the, you know, those sick and, you know, broken, dangerous people. And I just thought, well, I know there's one on the planet. It's me. What am I ever going to do? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're pack animals. And when we can understand that we're not the only one going through it, that helps a little bit. Not a lot, but it helps a little bit.
Is there something about the institutional and religious homophobia of the past couple of decades that was almost like a dress rehearsal for the kind of dehumanizing rejection of progressive Americans and values that we are now seeing from the political religious right?
So, yeah, we understand that the when the rhetoric gets ratcheted up, everything else gets ratcheted up. Our the value of people in the LGBTQI community got ratcheted down policy wise. You know what I think was the worst part, Welton, and I think this is important to note, that it was the gaslighting. It was the gaslighting from Trump supporters during his administration that said, no, Trump is actually great for gays. He actually loves gays. He's actually done more for gays than most Democrats. So not only do we have to kind of fight the power, the people making, you know, with the biggest platforms, then we have to fight the people who have been gaslit or gaslighted, however you say that. We have to undo that as well. Like, I don't need someone to tell me how great this administration has been for me. No, you gotta, he loves gays. See that picture of him wrapped in that rainbow flag? He loves gays. That's a problem, and we have to undo some of that. So, you know, I like to think strategically, Welton, as you know I do. And so I, with my advocacy kind of thought partners in different organizations that I work with, we are doubled and tripled down on strategy, because as strategic as the evangelical right, people who are anti-gay, I don't like to say they're homophobic because that means they're afraid of gays. I don't think they're afraid of gays. I think they are against us. Mm-hmm. I think they just don't like us. And I think they also know that's a language that helps them kind of turn and amp up their base. So the anti-gay evangelical political establishment, as strategic as they are against us, and they lay out business plans, actual business plans to figure out ways to suppress us. We have to answer that with strategy. So I am excited that the advocacy groups I work with and have relationships with, we are doubling and tripling down on our strategy.
Not everybody knows that over the years you have founded not one but two charitable foundations, both of which focus on bettering the lives of young people. You worked to promote music education in schools, and you've devoted a lot of your energy to the Like Me organization, which helps LGBT teens and their families and works to prevent bullying in youth suicide. I'd love for you just to take a few minutes and talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, Reading, Writing, and Rhythm, the first nonprofit that you mentioned, I got the idea for that, which we put musical instruments and funding into public schools. And over the course of, you know, we're at the $1 million mark in what we were able to do in public schools. That idea came to me after the events of Columbine. And as I was processing, you know, kind of as the nation was, what in the world could have unfolded to allow or cause that to happen? And it occurred to me that I don't in any way want to suggest that the boys who did that crime were victims. But it's hard to not unpack the whole thing and know that being left out in certain circles, people eventually find a place. If they are pushed out of one place, they will end up in another. And it strikes me as we're talking about this, Welton, how kind of parallel track that is to our current political situation. Mm-hmm. When a group is left out of a conversation, they will end up in another room having a different conversation. Mm-hmm. And the events of Columbine, I think, were, you know, perhaps a result of that. And so it occurred to me that, you know, where did I fit in when I was a kid? You know, I was an athlete, but I also didn't fit in a lot of ways. And I was a band geek and I loved it. And those are still my people to this day. And so that's where I got the idea to, you know what, let's try to make sure that every kid has access to a music program. And band instruments are expensive. A saxophone is, you know, you can spend $1,000 on a saxophone easily. And so we started raising money and giving away musical instruments in public schools. Welton, I still receive correspondence to this day from people who say, hey, I found you on the internet, or I found your Twitter. I don't know if you remember this, but years ago in, you know, Northern California, you came to my school and you gave me a trumpet. And I just want you to know I got a partial college scholarship with that trumpet. And I, you know, I'm in business school now, or that helped me. So that was a really satisfying endeavor. And then when I came out, I founded the Like Me organization. And, you know, being able to kind of interface with people, young people in particular, about, you know, how, again, pulling those pieces of themselves all together in one place is possible, and they are okay, and they are not broken, and they get to have, you know, access to community and resources. It's just really, really satisfying.
Would you just tell our listeners how they could get involved with the work of Like Me?
Yeah, they can go to likeme.org, or they can just go to my website, shelley.com, which is shely.com. Don't even need my last name. Shelley.com, and information is there. And thank you for that, Welton. Thank
you. You are not only into music wonderfully by the way you sing, but you also write music. And I just have been curious as to what kind of music have you been writing over the last 4 years, and what do you think is going to change in what you're writing now? Because I know you are impacted by what's around you and what's going on in you when you write the music that comes out of you. And I never liked that song where you talked about the coroner. And so what's coming now?
The Notes to the Coroner song of mine off of my Lifted Off the Ground record is historically your least favorite in my catalog.
That is true.
I appreciate that. You know, for your listeners, it's a song, it's a pretty upbeat, groovy tempo, but it's really about a dark topic. And it's a song that in which I write about, you know, my ending my life and what the coroner will be able to determine. And the narrative of the song is that, you know, I died of a broken heart. I died of brokenness. I died just of being exhausted from hiding who I was. So the sequel to that is that I did not end my life. I am quite here. I'm very much here. I won't write another song like that. I don't think for the rest of my life, but I do dally. I do like a sad song, Welton.
I know you do.
You wouldn't be in country
music if you didn't like a sad song.
Right. What do they say about country music? If you play a song backward, you get your wife, your dog, and your pickup truck back. I'm storytelling is important to me, and songwriting is, a medium that has been good to me. And I think the songs that I've written in the past 4 years have been strangely optimistic. I have to have a counterpoint to the negativity. So sometimes if there's a lot of darkness going around, you know, I write a dark song, but I think I've found in the past 4 years that I've been somehow subconsciously, unconsciously writing counterpoints to that. Mm-hmm. But I've also been writing, essays and working on a couple of books, and they are really about counterpoints in getting other people to tell their stories. I'm working on a book now that's coming out on Simon & Schuster in the fall, and it's based 100% on getting other, women around the globe to tell their stories about triumph and to tell their stories about, stepping into their power. And I have to tell you, I hit my deadline a week ago, and I'm, getting the last materials in for the project. But after having worked on that for about 14 months, I am fired up about finding ways to get other people to tell their stories, because it is only when people see their lives and their truths reflected in literature and poetry and music and film, it is only then when people can begin to feel the wholeness of their being. And right now I'm feeling so great about helping people get their stories on tape or on paper. Mm. And that's kind of where I am right now.
Good for you. Shelley, I think the last time that we talked with each other on the air, you had just released your Christmas EP, Santa Will Find You. And to be honest, when I picked up your latest EP, which is titled Revival, I thought for a minute we were going to get some gospel music from you, but this is a set of thoughtful, very you songs, really good. And I want to ask you, if you have a favorite song from Revival, I wish you would tell us that.
Oh, thank you for that. I do have a favorite on that record, and it is the song Revival. The title track was the center of why that EP came to be. And I think what that song talks about really, again, speaks to where we are right now. How lucky are we to have second chances? Mm-hmm. How lucky are we, whether it be in our spiritual life, in our physical life, when someone overcomes a health crisis, when someone gets through a four-year administration like we've just gotten through with new and truthful leadership, I feel like Revival speaks to second chances. And although it's talking about an interpersonal relationship, I think it's a universal theme. What would we do? What would I do without second chances?
I've been around a block or two. The seasons will come like they do. I'm holding on to threads of us, 'cause time away from you wasn't enough to get me over. I know enough to know I can't control all these emotions when they overflow. I've got this intuition, I can keep you in my vision. At least I keep on wishing for a revival. Revival. We had it all, fireworks exploding and lighting up our world. Then things I can't recall now piled up, and for the life of me I don't know what.
Shelley Wright is an award-winning musician, an author, and a passionate activist whose last EP is titled Revival. Shelley, it strikes me that as we hopefully finally emerge from a period defined by lies and inauthenticity, you stand as such an example of the struggle for personal honesty and integrity. And as long and as painful as that struggle has been for you, today I see you standing. I am so proud of you, both professionally and personally, as an example of thriving in your truth. I am more than grateful to call you friend. And I am grateful to have you with us again on State of Belief.
Welton, if tears can track on radio, you can certainly hear mine, and I have a lump in my throat. Authenticity is often a practice, and I have to remind myself every day that I am here for a reason. I survived what I survived. I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be with the voice that I have right now, because it was given to me by God. And you have become, well, you're one of my best friends, and you're my family, and you are a North Star for me, and your friendship has lifted me up and held me up and cheered me on. You performed my wedding ceremony. You have held my babies in your arms. You are my one of my people, and I love you, and I love being a part of this show, and I just thank you. Thank you, Wilton. I love you so much.
Well, same here, and thank you for this today on State of Belief Radio. Now, before we go,
from the nation's capital, Mutual Radio presents The Larry King Show.
Earlier this month, we saw scores of people grieve over Larry King's death and celebrate his life and work. I cannot help but reflect on a few good memories I have of experiences with Larry. In 2003, as president of Interfaith Alliance, I had the great pleasure of presenting Larry King with Interfaith Alliance's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award. Those two men were friends who respected each other. The joy of that evening is etched into my psyche. One evening while I was watching King's show, I was stunned as well as excited when he told one of his guests about that evening. Larry said his acceptance of this award in the name of Cronkite, the most trusted man in America, was one of the best honors he had ever received. After that experience, I had the privilege of spending more times with King. He was kind enough to invite me to a gathering in his home. Later, he invited me to visit him while he was doing his show. Larry was interested in a book that I had published, which was similar to a book on a topic on which he was working. My book, titled I Give You My Word, Sharing the Language of Life, was a collection of various people's favorite word or words. Larry King's contribution was loyalty. It needs no explanation, King told me, adding, quote, my favorite phrase is walk in the other man's shoes. I've always tried to feel, think, and wonder what makes the other person tick. What's it like in their shoes? Larry spent much of his life helping us know better the thousands of people with whom he talked on the air. And I know he'd be pleased to know how many of us try to follow his example of how to ask questions and, more importantly, how to listen to the answers. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein.
State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.